Okay, we continue our research efforts.
Yes. Good afternoon, everybody. We've got a series of papers here for you, series 9 on rate regulation, and Jane's going to take us through. What we want to propose is that we deal with paper 9C first, which is the one that's about the interim project that we've got and the ED that was published earlier this year. And then once we've discussed that, then we'll move on to the rest of the papers, which deal with the comprehensive project that is leading towards the discussion paper.
Okay, thanks, Michael. Yeah, so as Michael said, we're on paper 9C now, which is dealing with the interim project to develop some temporary short-term interim guidance, mainly directed towards first-time adopters to allow them to transition to IFRS while still maintaining their existing policies for the rate-regulated activities. We wanted at this stage to just give you a high-level summary of the responses. Paper 9C was posted on the 5th of September. Just to let you know that the closing date for comments was the 4th of September. So this paper is just a very quick review of those early comment letters. I do have some numbers if you would like to update some of the numbers in here. But the messages primarily are repeated in the later letters that we've got. So what I'd like to do is just give you a quick update on the numbers, flag up some of the key messages that were heard, and then open up your discussion and debate. We're not planning on asking you any specific for any decisions at this meeting. It really is just to give you a flavour of what we've got so far, and we'll bring a more detailed analysis to try and start the re-deliberations of the proposals in October. So if I take you first of all, we put some totals in paragraphs 4, 5 and 6 with the letters that we'd received at the closing date. In paragraph 4, we said at that stage we'd had 84 responses. That now is 113 from 26 different countries. So again, still the whole 7 geographical regions. In paragraph 5, of the respondent types now, the largest number is still the preparers and the preparer representative bodies, but that's now 49% rather than 51%. The other respondents, again, primarily standard setters has gone up to 19%, and the accounting firms or bodies has dropped down to 13%. So the percentages are very, very similar as we've gone through. More noticeably, I'm sure you're interested in paragraph 6, which is the very high level, do you support or agree with issuing an interim standard targeted at first-time adopters? Do you disagree with the issue of an interim standard, as in just disagree whether it's the first-time adopters or anybody else? The third category in paragraph 6C, with those respondents that disagreed with the proposals being targeted purely at first-time adopters, but were suggesting that any interim guidance should apply to all rate-regulated activity or rate-regulated entities, or those rate-regulated entities that have recently transitioned to IFRS and recently written off their accounting balances for regulatory activities, should they be allowed to bring it back? The numbers there have gone up. The supports have gone from 43 up to 59. The responses that disagree in paragraph 6B have gone from 23 to 30. And in paragraph C, the responses that think it should be broader than first-time adopters has gone from 18 up to 24. 59 are support. 59 support, 30 against, and 24 think it should be wider than first-timers.
But we don't count numbers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so now we have to count the not just the quantity, but also the quality and the volume.
The quality, indeed. Yeah.
Can I just ask you a question on the 54? Is it all from one region or one country? Look at the back.
Oh, so the 59.
Update, yeah.
Let me give you the update on the numbers in Appendix A. So if we're doing this by region, in Yeah, the 59, the supporters, are 4 from Europe, 47 North America.
Which 46 from Canada? Or?
I haven't got.
But from different provinces.
Yes. Lots of different provinces.
From Newfoundland, Newfoundland there too, Australia didn't come. It took some time because it's.
Okay. There were also a number of USA responses in there as
yeah,
well.
This indeed does show how completely misleading these numbers can be.
Yeah. The other agrees, 2 from Asia, 1 from Latin America, and 5 globals.
Are they the firms?
Mainly, yes, 5 of the large firms.
And the disagreeers?
The disagreeers, 8 from Europe, 2 from North... 15 disagree, 15 from Europe, 6 from Asia, 2 from Oceania, 3 global, and 4 from Africa.
But you need to really lump B and C category into one.
No, not necessarily.
Or A and... You could do A and C, yeah. They agree, and those that think that it should be done, but they want to be included as well.
Yeah. So those big firms supporting... let's assume you include big four firms, they send to us through their headquarters or through their local firm.
Through that global, their global group.
But by email.
A pigeon, truly.
Yeah, okay.
They always do global.
These are the global responses.
And who are the standard setter bodies supporters?
Give us their name.
Their name. That might be.
Other than Canada.
How many have we got that are standard setters that agree? I think one was from Oceania. Oh no, the one from Oceania was quite mixed, standard setting body. Germany and the Netherlands. 2 Europeans.
Germany and Netherlands agree now. Yeah. But make them 4. It's now 4 in support. It was 2, now it's 4.
Yeah.
No, those were the supporters.
You had 2 on as of September 5. No, how many do you have in support in the Star Setters?
0.
2.
Where are 2?
Appendix B.
3 standard setters support.
3 now, okay.
3 standard setters support.
Would it be a good idea to leave these details to the next meeting? One day after the, you know. And we're going to get a detailed report next time, and it'll just repeat things.
This was, by the way, just updated for this morning.
Or
so
maybe you
can
ask offline, because this is going to take a long time if we just keep going.
I don't know what else we're discussing.
We are allowed to have a little fun every now and then.
I can see Ian's discomfort.
One last question. I'm sorry.
I want to run a correlation too between those who disagree and those
counting
who
by the accounting firm, they are quite different.
Disclosures.
The accounting bodies.
Accounting
bodies
they should disagree. Accounting firms are supporting, but it seems to me they are quite similar preferences they must show. But in this case, it's just opposite. Because accounting bodies are usually not representing. The preferences of accounting firms, they must do that. Is that right? If in the case, maybe, for example, ICAW, maybe then the ICAW might show some kind of opinion based on their members' opinion.
I think the big difference is the accounting bodies are primarily national, whereas the accounting firm responses are global.
Yeah, but in this case, the all 5 accounting firms said yes.
Well, okay. Yeah, 5 of them.
We'll continue our in-depth analysis of the responses in the next meeting.
We'll give you some more detailed numbers ready for the next meeting. In terms of the messages, the key messages that have come through, I suppose paragraph 7 is the main one that was given by people who supported, didn't support, and were in the other category, is really to try and progress this project as in a timely manner as possible. Those that support the issue of an interim standard appreciate that having a limited population of entities able to use the interim standard does create some lack of comparability in that there'll only be a small population that full rate regulated activities can put these balances in the financial statements. Generally though, the majority were accepting that it increases comparability because if you isolate out those lines for regulatory balances, the rest of the financial statements then are based on the same accounting standards. Unlike at the moment where, for example, in Canada, several of the responses noted they're accounting for their regulatory balances in a similar way, so they've got comparability for the regulatory balances, but they don't have comparability for the rest of the financial statements because they're prepared under different frameworks. So US GAAP, pre-changeover Canadian GAAP, IFRS, and the same argument could apply globally as well, that there's lots of different frameworks being used. So the comparability is increasing throughout the rest of the financial statements. The lack of comparability is along the regulatory balances line. But all of them thought that, you know, a short-term project, several people warned that previous interim projects, short-term solutions, IFRS 4 and 6, are proving not to be very short-term. So if we do go ahead with the interim proposals, then it's important that we try and focus on the main project and get that done as quickly as possible. Other key messages coming through. The disclosure requirements, those generally have been very well supported. The vast majority of the responses supported the separation of the balances and the detailed disclosure requirements, including a lot of those that disagreed with the proposals but then did answer the individual questions on the basis that if the ISB go ahead, do we agree or disagree with the individual proposals? So the disclosures were thought to be a very important feature of this interim proposal, keeping that isolation, the separation, and the disclosures. Other key messages with the scope. In paragraph 9, I've just highlighted there, particularly paragraph 9A, when we looked at the 2009 exposure draft, the previous project, the scope the vast majority of people disagreed with because it focused on one particular type of rate regulation, cost of service. So even the respondents that were supporting the recognition of regulatory balances, many of those disagreed with the scope because it was felt to be too narrow. That's quite different with the interim standard, much more support for the scope, thinking that it is wider, it's more flexible than before. But there were a small number, but quite significant quality of discussion or comment that said, if we are focusing on first-time adopters only for this interim proposal, is there a need to further define the scope for any particular type of rate regulation? In the interim proposal, we do try and still identify some cause and effect relationship between costs and revenue. And some of these comments were saying that there's no need to do that. If it's first-time adopters, you're trying to lower the barriers for adoption of IFRS, then is there a need to have a second hurdle being a type of regulation? So that's something that we'll need to look at in more detail when we come back with the more detailed analysis. Of those disagreeing with the proposals, the majority of them were focusing on the comparability, saying that allowing different versions of IFRS to apply would reduce comparability. But again, we've addressed that. It does reduce it to some extent on the regulatory balances line, but not so much the rest of it. And then quite a number of respondents did agree with the alternative views put in the interim proposals themselves, paragraph 11A, so looking at the dangers of setting a precedent by issuing an interim solution for this particular issue and the possibility of more pressure being put on the board in future projects to allow a similar interim solution for other difficult issues going forward. So,
I thought we were following a precedent, not setting one.
Well, that could be argued, yeah. 4 and 6 perhaps set the precedent. But, yeah. that point, those are the key messages that I thought were important to flag up at this stage, but happy to take any comments or questions or any guidance for things you think that we should focus on for the detailed analysis coming back in October.
That was clear.
Excellent.
Sorry, just one comment on 9B, where you report there's general agreement with the isolation. Some suggest greater flexibility should be permitted, especially in P&L. First reaction is not positive about flexibility because it's about A, getting the project done, but B, very clearly sticking with that isolation. I don't know if there's something persuasive in the letters that argued that we should be aware of, but I think it would have to be something new and different.
I think the most persuasive aspect was probably there were several responses that commented on other comprehensive income and being able to split at least two lines being profit and loss and other comprehensive income. And the example given for the justification there is that pensions and the requirements for recognising some of the movements on pension liabilities goes through OCI under IS 19, and some of the movements on the regulatory balances would mirror those movements. And so the request coming through, could we?
That to me sounds more like the interaction with other standards point, actually.
Yeah.
So, okay.
All right.
Good. Okay. Moving on then, and moving away from the interim project and into the main research project, we've got papers 9A and 9B. They are interrelated because they really demonstrate the approach we're trying to take with this research project, which is a kind of twofold approach. One is we're trying to do more work on researching user needs and identifying what analysts and other users actually need to know about rate regulation and the interaction between the rate regulation and the financial statements. That's one side of it. The other side then is looking at what do we mean by rate regulation, what are the features of rate regulation that make it different from other types of business activities, and whether those features do create rights and obligations that should be recognised as assets and liabilities in the financial statements. Also, what disclosures would relate to those features, whether or not they end up being recognised as assets and liabilities at the end of the day. So we're trying to run these two strands of our research in parallel, but we're at early stages, obviously, of both of them. But we thought, again, at this meeting it was worth just giving you a highlight of where we're at with the user needs research. I think it provides a little bit of background for the next paper, 9B, when we start talking about the scope and the particular features that we'd like to focus on. So in paper 9A, you'll see from there we've been talking to our consultative group. That consultative group we mentioned in the July meeting because we looked at a very high-level summary in July of the responses to the request for information that was issued to help us gather more information about rate regulation. And we said at that meeting we were going to talk to our consultative group that met at the end of July. And we had a separate session at that meeting to try and identify some user needs. And the key messages there are in paragraph 6. What users are looking for are predominantly information about the amount, the timing, and the certainty of cash flows, which is heavily influenced by the actions of the rate regulator, and also information that allows them to reconcile the results in the financial statements, looking a lot at the earnings, but also some of the balance sheet figures as well. But can they reconcile the earnings, the results in the financial statements, with the amounts that they're permitted to recognise for regulatory purposes? Because the rate regulation, one of the common features we're going to touch on, is that the rate regulators will commonly set a level of revenue or a level of earnings that is a target for the regulated activities. and any amounts that are earned above the permitted amount will need to be adjusted in the future to pull it back or to refund those amounts to customers. Any amounts below the permitted level or the targeted level, there's an adjustment to then make sure that the entity remains viable and they can recoup those amounts in future periods. So the reconciliation, we were told, users find is very important between what the target is from the rate regulator, what is actually reported in the financial statements. We've also had a little bit of input. It's not formally recorded here in the paper, but EFRAG, the European standard setter or regulator, has also set up their own working group on rate-regulated activities. I've attended one of those meetings and a couple of follow-up meetings with their technical expert group and got more information there, and we're getting similar messages from the users on the EFRAG's group as well, the European group. In addition to talking to these consultative groups, we've also started to research the methodologies used by the credit analysts and the equity analysts. Again, we haven't sat down with these people yet and gone through these methodologies, but that's something that we're hoping to do in the future. But in paragraph 9, we've just highlighted some of the key things that the credit analysts use in particular, and the information that they need to work their models for their credit ratings. And again, you'll see there some of this is quite similar to the messages we were told at the consultative group meeting. They're very interested in what is the influence of the rate regulator on the amount, the timing, and the certainty of those cash flows. Some of that information is qualitative, so what's the relationship with the regulator? How supportive is the regulator of the entity, not just the customer? And again, that's a feature that we're going to come to talk about, is the balance between the interest of the customer, the interest of the entity supplying the goods and services. And again, in paragraph 9D, highlighted there, the credit rating agencies are very focused on the mechanisms that the regulators use to ensure the amount of the revenue and the earnings that are generated by the rate-regulated activities, and those adjustments built into the mechanism to make sure that those even out over time. Again, in this paper, we're not asking you to make any particular decisions. It's really giving you some additional background, asking if you've got any particular questions or comments, anything that you'd like us to particularly focus on in our future research.
Jane, I had a question, your observation. In light of the information you're learning about the nature of information and what various investor groups are focused on, what they find of interest, does it make sense to factor that into the interim project at all? If it takes several years to finish this project, 3, 4, 5, 6 years, and we know today that this is information that people like to see, they use, but perhaps is not making its way into financial statements, should we deal with that sooner rather than later, rather than wait 6 years, for example, to introduce it when we know now?
I mean, we haven't had huge numbers of responses from users on the interim exposure draft, but those that we have are quite supportive of the disclosures that are in there.
Well, we don't count comment letters, right? We just look at quality.
Just look at the quality. And again, what I would like to do is just double check those disclosures. We did try and take into account what we'd heard already about the user needs at that stage in making the proposals for the interim. And so I think it does make a lot of sense to see if we need to tweak those disclosures. But the ones that are in the exposure draft already are trying to focus on the amount, the timing, and the certainty of the cash flows. From memory, there's not too much in reconciling the earnings figure across, so perhaps that is something we'll look at more closely. But certainly the disclosures in there are geared up to the timing of the cash flows and the amounts.
Very good.
Jane, I have 3 points. Firstly,
anytime we ask the user needs, we have to be very careful whether they want information which they feel must be formally recognized in the financial statement. Alternatively, you know, if you disclose comprehensively, they feel it's okay. I hope in the future you should, you know, dig into more further. And otherwise, you know, the image we can get will be quite accurate. And secondly, I'm not sure how many users from now IFRS world in the group.
Yeah, in the consultative group, we've got two credit analysts, one from Canada and one from the USA. We've got a securities regulator, again, from the USA. We were somewhat limited with the number of applications we got from users from non-North American countries.
Now, the reason why I ask this question is, if the purpose to establish this group is purely to get information, it's okay, you know. But if the purpose to establish this group will provide us advisors how to go ahead, I have some concern, you know.
Gotcha.
And because, you know, nowadays, you know, in our world, we assume, you know, nearly all of the companies will not use this system. And we have to ask the users whether you feel satisfactory or not. And in particular, I would strongly suggest you to use the Brazilian experience. You know, Brazil recently adopted our standards. They work very hard to push those companies to abolish their previous practice and also require them to disclose the information based on the previous based on the regulatory requirements. And then to ask whether the users there feel the information, what they can get now, better than the past practice or not. And my last question is, you mentioned several times about the cash flow. It related the possible principles we may arrive at. My guess is, if the possible consequence is like something similar to the 2009 AD, which is actually on aggregate basis, which may also based on expected value notion. I feel very doubt whether they can get any clause related to cash flow and others, because you will combine all the factors all together. It is very hard. By contrary, if you follow the traditional, maybe 30 or 40 years ago, traditional regulatory activities, there is a so clear relationship between the effects and the costs. And the regulator pull any submissions by this way, and you recognize this way and disclose this way, it will be easier, straightforward.
Mm.
But I don't expect we will arrive at such kind of accounting principles, because you clearly want to expand the scope. And so I doubt, you know, even though people say, that users say that we want to know the possible impact on cash flow, the earnings, and others, I feel doubt. The possible principles will give them such information.
Yeah. I mean, that's why, if I can come back, your first point, this is not being driven just by the user, because, you know, there may be things that the users want or the users say that they need, but it's not possible for us to deliver them within financial statements. What we're trying to do is take this two-pronged tack on this project. One is, can we identify what it is that the users want, what it is that they see as distinguishing rate-regulated entities from other types of entities, but at the same time, focusing on what are the details about rate regulation looking at that within our conceptual framework to see whether there are principles that we can identify, that we can perhaps come up with an accounting model that, that would work within our boundaries. In an ideal world, the two will match up together. But I'm not an economist, so I don't live in the ideal world. I'm sure they won't match up together. And then we need to consider what compromises might be needed to achieve one or other of those outcomes. But certainly the consultative group, coming back to your other point, the consultative group is not a decision-making group. It's, as the title says, we will consult them, gather information, we can gather their views, but the decision-making body is sat around this table, so that will drive it. And the user needs are an important factor, but it's only half the story.
Martin.
Yeah, and I understand really that users want to really have information about the amount, time and uncertainty of this cash flows from these activities, but then if I read paragraph 7, that was very interesting, because that is said here, we also heard that even in the restrictions where regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities are currently recognized in the statements of financial position, such as in the USA and Canada, the financial statements rarely provide the information needed to complete the analyst's assessment. If I would conclude from that, is okay, then maybe we should stop the project, because I think we have done a lot of research, because we have found really empirical studies where people can do in the US and Canada, because there these assets and liabilities are on the balance sheet, and that is, I think, what we try to achieve with this project. But even though, then the users say, okay, that is not sufficient, and we need other information, and other information is then the second paragraph to paragraph 7 is saying, okay, that information is more than from filings to the regulators where they get this kind of information. And what is the consequence from that? And I would say, okay, maybe we should focus our research really on users in the US and saying, okay, because they have that on the balance sheet, does it really help? Or is that not sufficient? Because if they're not really helping, then we should stop the project.
I would challenge one statement of yours, though, that the object of this project is to put the assets and liabilities on the balance sheet. I don't think that's the object at all. We have diverse practice. We have diverse opinions. The object is to find out what the proper financial reporting is, and that may be not putting the items on the balance sheet. So, I think that's the object of the project, not to put the items on.
And I think the question is that financial assets or liabilities requested or following from this regulatory activities? That is what I think is the objective of that.
Sorry.
And if that is not a poor disclosure project, it is a kind of question is, should we bring that on the balance sheet or not? That is my understanding of the project.
Well, we're agreeing then. Our first objective is to find out whether they should go on or not. And that's largely be a conceptual question. But
isn't it really that we want to provide users with the kind of information which they need? And if I read paragraph 7, that we have empirical evidence from some jurisdiction where this user say, okay, even is on balance sheets, it does not provide us with sufficient information which we need.
But financial reports seldom provide them with all the information they need. And I think they're just making the point they need other information as well. And that's quite normal.
Yeah, but on the second paragraph, it is said, okay, that information is already available to make this kind of cash flow forecast. And if that is the aim, which is said in paragraph 6, then the question is, do we have to, in addition, to bring that in the financial statements? And that, I think, is a research project, is, I think, the first phase is to find that out before we try to find a solution for that. What I have not read it, as I have not written it, because I have read that is a conclusion from this first outreach which we have taken from users.
Yeah.
Users' perspective is not my perspective.
I mean, despite the fact that the analysts say that they can get it, these are specialist analysts that spend a lot of time trying to get this information and gather it together, and then trying to compare it across to what's in the financial statements. So it's the desire is that still there, I think, for users to say, if this information can be can be put into the financial statements, it gives a much clearer, more understandable picture, because you're getting the bulk of the story in one place. You're not having to go to lots of different places that are coming at this from lots of different angles and then trying to work out how do they fit together. And I appreciate the point, you know, we're not trying to get the panacea and give them absolutely everything in one place, but I think we do need to analyse what is it that fits within our boundaries.
But that is not set in paragraph 7. That is that, okay, the financial statements rarely provide the information needed to complete the analyst assessment.
To complete that, it.
Yeah.
But if they didn't have what was there in the U.S. already, then they wouldn't even be able to begin it.
But sorry, read the second sentence. Information about the timing and certainty of cash flows and the reconciliation of reporting earnings to the earnings permitted by the rate regulation is more often found in rate filings or other sources of information. So it is not in the financial statements in the US and Canada found. That is my conclusion from that then.
That's the additional information that they need to complete their analysis.
Sorry, is that information not additional information about the timing and certainty of cash flows? It is not said additional information about the timing and... Sorry, maybe I... Read
but we are here to help them.
Yes.
Dare I say this is based on US
GAAP. That was the thrust of my
answer. So we haven't...
Let's get on with it.
We haven't analysed what the information is that will give them the package.
But my point is very easy. Based on that paragraph, I'm reading that even analysts which say in the US, in Canada, which have deep knowledge of this kind of industry, saying that even it is on the balance sheet and a lot of information in financial statements, that is not, it is only rarely gives them information about the certainty and timing of these cash flows. They found it, they will find it in the filings to the regulator, but not in the financial statements.
And I think
I'm reading paragraph 7.
I think it gives us a challenge to ask ourselves what information should we be ensuring is included in financial statements for users.
Maybe.
Okay, shall we move on?
Yep.
The rest of the session then is focusing on paper 9B and the supporting papers 9B1 through 9B3. This session is trying to establish a scope for the discussion paper. Again, in July, when we talked about the responses to the request for information, we talked about different types of rate regulation, and again, going back, we said earlier, the 2009 ED focused on a particular type of rate regulation. A lot of people call it cost of service regulation, and that caused so many problems because lots of people came back and said, that's only one particular type of regulation, it only applies in a particular jurisdiction, it's far too narrow, you need to broaden out the scope and capture other types of rate regulation. The request for information, that was one of the objectives, was to find out what are the types of rate regulation, but more than that, what was common to those different types of rate regulation, and perhaps we could focus in on those common features. And again in July, the summary that we talked about in paper 9 of the July meeting was saying that trying to use types of rate regulation was hugely difficult, partly because cost of service regulation in its purest form is at one end of an extreme. Incentive-based regulation is another extreme at the opposite end. And in reality, there's probably hardly any regulation at either extreme. Almost all rate regulatory schemes fall somewhere in between. But people will still use the high-level terminology and say, we're in a cost of service regime, but when you look at the detail, there's quite a few incentives built into it. You'll get others that say, we're in an incentive-based scheme, but they'll describe lots of cost of service type features in that scheme. And it's almost the same scheme, but different terminology used to describe it. So We discussed this with the consultative group in July, and generally the members there were in agreement that it gets very confusing, and perhaps to try and make this project more manageable and put a boundary on our detailed analysis, we would be better off just trying to identify what are the features that are common to different types of rate regulation in different jurisdictions. And we've summarised those in paper 9B, which is the kind of covering paper for 9B 1 through 3. The features here are the ones that we've identified as being common. The consultative group themselves gave us some high-level descriptions, which are in paragraph 12, and highlighted things like the monopoly status of the regulatory entity is important. In the majority of cases, there is only one supplier of the regulated goods or services, so they do have an exclusive supply position. There are some barriers to competition. Quite often these are natural barriers to competition, but they're commonly supported by the regulatory framework. So there are additional features built into the regulation that will stop competition. Also, they highlighted that the source of the rate regulator's authority is important. It's really not sufficient that a monopoly entity decides that they will regulate themselves. There's got to be some enforceability built into the rate regulation, which would normally be expected to come through an authorised body or some body that is supported by legislation. And also, paragraph 12D, the impact of the rate regulation on the timing of the cash flows, the level of assurance of the amounts of revenue, etc., being earned, is built into the rate regulation, so there's got to be a transparent mechanism for enforcing or applying the control over the prices. Also in paragraph 13 there, we've highlighted that the consultative group, we did discuss some other types of rate regulation, but generally these didn't contain all of the common features that we're going to go through in paragraph 14. And these are, eventually we came up with some terminology which was market regulation. It's not what a lot of people think of as rate regulated activities, and it's in situations where there is competition in the market, but it's not very efficient competition because there are only a small number of competitors, so they are in fairly strong market positions. And a couple of examples that were given of this type of regulation are things like in the EU. There's a cap on how much the telecommunication companies can charge for roaming between different EU countries using your mobile phone. So for text messages, for mobile phone messages, there's a maximum amount that the local national suppliers can charge for other suppliers to use that. Another example we talked about was the banking industry and credit cards. There's a cap in lots of places where the charge fee paying by credit card instead of debit card, there's a cap on the credit card charge. And again, that's not what people were envisaging when we were talking about rate regulated activities. Mm-hmm. So before we just move into the summary of the common features, I just wanted to highlight that, because what we're trying to do here is not necessarily broaden the scope of entities that might be captured by the discussion paper and any subsequent guidance we might be able to produce. What we're trying to do is find a scope that we can actually, I think Ian, you said this phrase, put our arms around and have a detailed debate about in a structured way. And there may well be other features of rate regulation that we don't capture within that scope, but the discussion paper will give people an opportunity to bring in additional features if they think they're needed, and also to bring in ideas about whether entities outside of the scope that we capture should still be caught by some of the disclosures that we're
making. Making the scope manageable?
Yeah.
And without saying everything that becomes within scope. within the scope will be or doesn't follow automatically that it can define that scope with everything within there, that we will be able to formulate a standard for.
Yes, absolutely.
And regulatory assets or liabilities.
So we're not saying that these features will lead to the recognition of assets and liabilities. We're not saying that they will automatically result in some sort of standard. It's just given us some manageable starting point for that discussion and to use common features to then do the analysis in the conceptual framework as to whether they do create assets and liabilities or not.
I have a comment about vocabulary, and I think I understand why you're talking about common features, but actually I think if we were to try and find what are features that are common to all kinds of regulation, it would give us features that don't differentiate ones we potentially might want to capture versus ones we do. And I think what you're actually describing in this paper are differentiating features that are found in more than one kind of regulatory regime, but differentiating in the sense that they appear to create different economics, different, raise the question about whether there should be different accounting for them. So it isn't that we are trying to define characteristics that are common across all rate regulation, but find differentiating features that are present in more than one regime.
Yeah.
That's being kind of techy about it, but it isn't to try and cast as wide a net as possible and find a common denominator. It's to find differentiating characteristics that are present.
Yeah. Thanks, Mary. That articulates it far better than I did.
Can I ask if you apply this filter, which I actually like, I think you've done a very nice job. What kinds of entities today that are using rate regulatory accounting would fall in or fall out? How much of the current universe would you capture or not capture?
It's hard to say at this stage because it is very early.
Right.
But I think certainly a lot of the utilities that would consider themselves as being rate regulated entities would probably still be captured within this. And whether some of the others, such as the insurance industry, there are certain very narrow types of insurance contracts that possibly would get captured within this. It's too early to say at this stage, but certainly, you know, they seem to be realistic differentiating features that would still leave us with a population that it's worth looking at.
Right, okay.
A question, Jane, about paragraph C. In the scope, C, because obligations on the supplier to protect the quality and availability of the supply of regulated goods and services. Let's take an example, the UK franchises for railways.
Yeah.
I read in the newspaper yesterday that one of the franchises has been fined for trains being late. Would our standard capture this kind of mechanism?
For the UK rail industry, again, too early to be definitive, but I'm not sure that the UK system, I haven't investigated it in enough detail, but from what I know, I doubt that it would be captured by all of these features, partly because of the mechanism that applies, in that it's focusing, in my opinion, on more on the consumer than on the entity. And it's a very difficult balance for the UK rail regulator, because they're trying to reduce the subsidy that is given to the rail operators and put the onus on the cost of running the railway more on the consumers. But at the same time, the way that the prices are set are not designed to make sure the rail companies don't go bust, which has been proved because one or two of them have failed.
I agree that the basic pricing of the train tickets or the season cards, all that should be probably outside. But in the case where you have a specific mechanism whereby the quality of service or the lack of quality might result in some penalties, under your little C, it might look like it will be captured. So
but it's only one of many criteria, isn't it?
It's one of many, yes, of course.
So
yes.
You have to pass all the criteria.
Well, you can say it's an essential service, it's exclusive right because it's monopoly. On one line, it's a monopoly. So it could meet all those criteria as well. So the question is, where do we stop here?
I mean, I take that point and confirm what Ian has just said. I mean, at this stage, we're just trying to get a general feel. Is this a sensible starting point? And then in future discussions, we will need to drill down and look at these in a lot more detail in the interaction. But the example that you've given, I would classify that, I think, at this stage, a little bit more like the market regulation,
yeah.
In that it applies to everybody. It's not necessarily just it's part of the rate regulation, but it's not specific to the rate itself. It's a type of regulation. And these companies will be subject to environmental regulations, all sorts of different types of regulation that may get captured in the paperwork of rate regulation, but it's not specific to the rate itself.
Stephen?
I'm still not quite clear how the features in paragraph 12 will be turned into a scope.
Sorry, the paragraph 12 is the high-level stuff. Paragraph 14, and it was 14C, I think, that Philippe was relating to. The way that we envisage these being the scope is that if we can establish, these are the features that we're looking at, and this is what we're going to drill down to. The scope of any guidance that we might be able to produce isn't necessarily going to be defined by these features. These features are trying to define the scope of the discussion paper, and are these the elements that we're going to focus on in trying to determine what is it that distinguishes these types of activities from general activities to give us a basis for getting into the conceptual framework.
Okay.
I think I would be remiss if I don't thank the consultative group for an excellent participation in July. I really enjoyed that interaction and their sincere inputs. I think that needs to be told first. The second thing, I think, Jane, this is not an idea to reduce the scope or increase the scope or anything, but I may not be around. I will not be around, let me put it that way. I will not be around here, but I may not be around the world. But one thing I really picked up, and I think the gentleman's name is Jesus from Spain, who raised the issue. I think it is worthwhile for the board members to be highlighted about the IFRIC-12 interaction with the rate regulated. And I'm not telling you to do it now, do it later, but I'm just telling you that it might be helpful for people to think about it. I did not think about it until I participated in that roundtable. And it's very interesting to see the airport, the roads, how they are talked about. So I think it would be worthwhile to talk and scope how this interacts with the IFRIC 12.
Yeah, definitely IFRIC 12 is on our radar, definitely. And again, it's difficult at this stage, and the people on the consultative group that have been trying to think about it, and there are some there that are working in entities that have got subsidiaries in the US, and in other countries in the world where they do recognise these balances, they're struggling to see how the interaction works. But again, I think until we can identify the beast that we're dealing with.
Like I said, don't restrict yourself, but I think it will be worthwhile just to put that marker once in a while in people's mind, because I think it was a very interesting conversation. Yeah. So.
Jen, one thing I think, you should be very careful about obligation side. And last month, you presented us with a list of obligations imposed on the regulatory entities. And I'm not sure, firstly, when we decide the boundary of the scope, what are those obligations will be taken into consideration, firstly. And secondly, when we discuss whether those rights obligations meet definition of asset liability, we should also be very careful. You know, what are those obligations which we will discuss? And you just mentioned, I partially agree, partially not agree. You said, you know, if it is related to regulating the setting, it's okay. Others not. But think about, you know, for environmental considerations, government imposed significant obligations on the utility company, said you must replace current plant. It will be create significant impact on its cash flow, on future earnings and others. And you may say no, it will not be taken into consideration. And because it may not directly link to rate setting in the coming future. And I think you should be very careful. The example I give to you will create huge obligation, will have significant impact on cash flow. But whether we will discuss this will create any impact our decision about asset liabilities, I think we should be very careful. So I worry about the obligation side, because you list so many obligations last month's worth.
Yeah. So in terms of these various features, we've broken them down into three separate papers just to make each one a little bit more manageable, but we envisage that they do interreact quite a lot, and our proposal is really that all of these features need to be present. I don't propose to go through all of these papers in a great deal of detail unless anybody wants to pick up on particular points. Paper 9B1 in particular is looking at the sole supplier of the essential goods, and that highlights those features such as the exclusive right that's backed up by the regulation, so it's not just a natural monopoly, that there's some backing in there. It talks about the essential or near essential nature of the goods and services, and again this is one area that I envisage we will need a much more detailed debate if you accept that this is one of the features that we should be focusing on in the discussion paper. One of the questions, and again PK will remember that Jesus was quite vocal in talking about how essential toll roads are in certain jurisdictions, in certain parts of the world, and whether they're essential or could you go trekking through the hills through little dirt tracks as an alternative, which means that it's not an essential facility. But that was a feature that I think lots of people talked about in the context of the combination of them, meaning that not only do you have a reasonable certainty of the volume of sales that you're likely to make in the future, so it gives some sort of assurance about recoverability or reversal of over-recoveries, but also that was drawn out as a feature that because of the relative inelasticity of demand, the regulator has got the flexibility to design a mechanism that instead of involving an immediate cash refund or a cash recovery means that it can be done over time through the future sales. So that's the reason for highlighting those as distinguishing features, which in combination people felt was an important part of that mechanism of the regulatory framework. There were other elements about the infrastructure restrictions. What is common to lots of different types of regulated industries, particularly things like transport, telecommunications, utilities, is the need for substantial infrastructure that can't be substituted, so that's in effect a natural barrier to competition. In looking at this, the staff's view was that this wasn't necessarily an essential differentiating feature. You can get that in other types of industries as well. So we saw this more as a common characteristic that isn't necessarily essential, but we could debate it and discuss it in the discussion paper just to see whether people have a different view of how essential that is. But on that basis, I just draw your attention to the questions, and unless anybody have got any particular points on these aspects, whether you're happy to proceed with us incorporating these in the statute.
Martin? Yeah, one question, and it is to the first criteria, which we think, okay, it must be in monopoly status, and based on my understanding, in many countries, especially in Germany, it is not that all rate regulated activities since the supplier have a monopoly status, because the direction is to open the market, and before it is open, I think they allow some competition. So I think it is a kind of development where maybe two or three suppliers are really rate regulated, and I'm a little bit concerned if we say it isn't only this kind of start of monopoly, we will exclude this kind of development which we see in many countries where they're going from a monopoly status into maybe in some entities which are then rate regulated, with then maybe in the future with an open competitive market. And the question is, do we want to have that so only monopoly, or do we want to enlarge it a little bit wider if it is not so close a monopoly button?
I think I was perhaps a bit too subtle in the question, which was an exclusive or near exclusive, right? Very much for that situation. In some places, they are trying to open up to competition, but it's obviously going to take some time. They've got to protect the supplier as well as the customer, because it is an essential type of service. So, again, in the debates, I think we do need to have that discussion as to how strict. Yeah. These individual features are, but you're quite right to flag that up.
This is a situation of an oligopoly, and where it's difficult for the customer in practice to move from one supplier to the other one. Although in theory, legally it could, but would that be also in the scope of?
Again, that's one of the reasons why we're looking to get the combination of features, because that on its own has got the potential to capture so many different scenarios, which is not the intention of this. And I don't think the rights and obligations that people see as differentiating rate regulated entities from general commercial entities would be present in that situation.
Jungle.
Thank you. So just what do you expect maybe the scope you are going to suggest in the DP or next meetings? I'm just wondering whether the format of appeals might be similar to the current existing standards, for example, IFRS 4 or IFRS 6, and so on. So is there quite similar form, or you are going to change some different for it? Because this is quite, maybe I'm sure, quite related to Stephen's comment and Mary's comment. It seems to me you are the paper very, very written, but you are analyzing everything. But it seems to me you are going to propose a kind of some different type of scope from the existing ones.
Yeah, I think perhaps Mary touched on this, perhaps it's the terminology. When we're talking about scope in the discussion paper, we're not trying to identify a particular type of rate regulation. What we're just trying to say is if you're in a rate regulated environment and you can identify that you have these features, then you need to read on, because that's what we're trying to capture. If you think that you're rate regulated but you're not and you don't recognise that you've got all of these features, you still need to read on, because you might think that you should be captured.
Yeah.
And we're trying to, again, we're not trying to set standards here. We're not trying to come up with proposals for a mechanism to recognise these things on balance sheet. What we're trying to do is just make the project manageable, that we can focus in on these particular aspects that we think, A, differentiate these types of activities from general commercial activities, and B, allow us to hang our analysis of assets and liabilities off these features, just to give us something to work with. Does that address your question?
Regarding infrastructure feature, I think it's good. It's not essential, so it's good. But moreover, I don't think it's necessary to touch upon as a common characteristic, because now, at the moment, most of the rate-regulated company who is accusing that we are rate-regulated company are now infrastructure business. However, there could be a much more industry segment, like social security service or elderly care, whatever, which do not really need infrastructure. So the insurance is the, one of the examples. Yeah. So therefore, I don't think it is really necessary to touch upon that, you know, having an infrastructure is a common feature.
Okay.
Okay. Otherwise, I don't know if you want to vote on each of these or just take a general vote at the end. You just general vote at the end. You okay now to move on to paper 9B2?
Yes.
Okay. 9B2 is a slightly different format than the others, because it deals with the definition of the rate regulator, and the reason it's a slightly different format is this sort of builds on the 2009 exposure draft and is trying to build on an aspect that was less controversial, so we thought we could perhaps move on at a slightly faster pace on this one. And it's looking at what do we mean by the rate regulator and how do we define it. And in paragraph 3, we've just drafted what we think would be a minor change to the wording, but we think would add clarity to the meaning of what we're talking about with a rate regulator, the definition. And throughout the paper, we highlight why we've made those changes. The first one talks about the problems highlighted in the previous project, and that's why we're trying to address them. But it talks about the regulator being empowered by statute or other contract. That was a problem because people felt that establishing the regulation by contract would capture these monopoly type or oligopoly type entities that just choose themselves to regulate their prices, and they just sign a contract with their shareholders or whatever. So it doesn't really establish the same rights and obligations as a formal rate-regulated entity. Also, the question marks about the regulator setting the rates that bind the entity and its customers, because in lots of regulatory schemes, the rate regulator does offer some flexibility on pricing. Philippe mentioned the UK rail regulator. If any of you do travel by train frequently, you'll realise that there are some prices that are regulated, which tend to be season tickets, and there's a fixed formula for those. Other prices, particularly off-peak prices, the train companies can do all sorts of things with those to incentivise people to travel off-peak, avoid the busy times, etc.
Jen, I don't know if you just made a Freudian slip, but you said rates that bind an entity and its customers.
And a customer, yeah. It was.
There's an entity's customers, and that confused me a lot. I think it binds the regulated entity, doesn't it? Not the customer.
I think it does bind both of them. I think you're right, Ian, and perhaps that's something that we need to tweak the wording.
Yeah. I think it might only bind the entity, which is then bound to only offer a particular rate on the market. Customer still has the right to buy or not.
In a railroad industry example, that might be true, but in a utility, I don't know whether that works as cleanly as it possible. So I think it depends on the circumstances in my mind.
Yeah.
Maybe
so
you needed that.
Be careful about how you define the regulator.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Ian, you know, this part, I never be convinced, but this is a key portion of the logic why some people will feel there is asset liability, because you can bind the customer.
Mm.
I'm not agreeing.
Well, I'm not sure it's important that you have to bind the customer to get to the answer they want, but that's for later. I just think the fact is that normally a regulator deals directly with the regulated entity. Doesn't deal with the customer at all. it tells the regulated entity what it can do and binds it.
But customer is not just you or me, it's a group of people in some circumstances. Again, the definition is, who is the customer, we don't know yet.
But the customer is bound because the entity is a monopoly, really, at the end of the day. So whatever price the entity wants to set, customer doesn't have much choice. But I don't think the regulator binds the customer. But anyway.
No, I can think you're right.
By the way, these train tickets, you were mentioning train tickets in the UK, are they being kept artificially low or artificially high?
No.
That depends on how big the subsidy should be.
Depends on the lines, certainly not.
But just given the back and forth on binding the customer, makes me wonder if in the paper we should include a specific discussion of that question, whether the rate regulation has to consider only the provider, or whether it also has to bind the customer, and then talk about whether binding the customer
makes any
means
difference.
Whether, as long as the customer could elect not to buy something, if that makes it not applicable or not.
Yeah, or could elect to buy less.
But I just think, because it's something that keeps resurfacing, binding the customer, acting on behalf of the customer, it would be better to have an explicit discussion of it, especially in phase one, and get that on the table.
Yeah.
As I said, we should be very careful. This is the most important foundation for those people who say there is a life obligation.
Yeah.
If we shake this part, there is no basis. You can lock the custom basis and the demand,
wow.
And then it's hard to justify. No, I'm not agreeing, but if those people say we should delete that portion and that the whole basis will, I'm sure, Jen, I'm right or not?
Well, possibly, yeah. I think you're right. This is something to investigate, because I struggle to separate out these features, because I see it's the combination of the rights and the obligations that distinguish these from other entities. So monopoly supplier in a general environment may have the right to be the monopoly supplier, just because there's too many barriers to competition, nobody else has come in. So you've got a right that you can sell at whatever price you want to sell at. One of the distinguishing features there, though, is that if somebody comes along and says, I want to buy your product at a different price that's much lower, you can just turn around and say, go away, I'm not going to do it. With rate regulation, if somebody comes to you that you don't want to sell to, but they demand that you sell, part of the obligation is that you have to do it, and it may cost you an awful lot more. I'm going to be following the latest discussions on privatisation of Royal Mail and the mail delivery service in the UK that's just been announced, because one of the things that was stopping that being privatised in the past is that it costs an awful lot more to deliver letters to lots of rural areas than it would do in London. And that's one of the features of rate-regulated activity, is that it's to protect customers in areas where, in a general commercial environment, the supplier would often choose not to supply because it's too expensive to supply, it's too difficult to supply. They wouldn't be able to do it at a price that would be affordable by the customers. So, you know, there's other sides to the rate regulation that all intertwine.
Another, I don't think you should overemphasize the monopoly position either, because in some circumstances, for instance, I'm going to build a new facility, and I can choose to heat it by gas or heat it with electricity. And I go to the electricity company and I say, you give me the right price, I'll heat it with electricity. So you don't have complete being...
You can choose to stay in your house with candles, but the question is that realistic?
Essential versus...
Again, the customer is...
That's why it is an important question, because the more that is the case, the more shaky the whole foundation of these regulatory assets becomes. Because the more uncertain it becomes in the future, if it is really that easy to switch between gas and electricity, one is regulated, the other isn't. The more questionable it becomes that you will be able to cash in on these regulatory assets.
Real life.
If both are regulated, then what do you do?
Well, it's still competition there, Peter. The real life example is in Australia, where the cost of electricity has been going up substantially. It's regulated. And the consumption of electricity is going down. The country's growing at a reasonable rate. The consumption of electricity is going down. People are using alternative sources of energy.
So they put their echo higher or lower?
No, they do all sorts of things. So
now in the UK, the opposite way.
Yeah.
Since the gas has increased, people buy
more electricity, which was my point about the new facility.
Yeah.
But I think the customers, the utility company has the right to charge higher, subject to regulator agreeing on the lower customer base or the lower consumption. So those are the things. Again, this is not the debating situation. It is only question seeking information situation.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things we need to think is who are those customers?
Yeah.
And I think you also have to distinguish whether it's an issue of recognition of whether something exists and the measurement of it. So you might conclude that it exists, but because all these other alternatives are coming in, the value of that asset keeps shrinking, even though there's still only one game in town for the provision of gas or one game in town for the provision of electricity. If everything is going to wind, it doesn't mean that gas and electricity aren't necessarily monopolies anymore, but it might mean the value of their assets are de minimis, to use a...
I was really warning against just assuming because you've got a monopoly, you can do what you like.
Yeah.
And that is, it is a not an inelastic market.
Jim, can I ask a question about 23, paragraph 23, about self-regulatory entity?
Mm-hmm.
And two questions. One question is, in our dissent opinion on 2000 ED, we don't agree, or we feel not so happy to include the board and about the company, not outside the regulator. And I'm not sure exactly where you are, you know. And secondly, right after that, you also said, you know, cooperative is okay. Please give us explanations of why cooperative bodies is okay. So
yeah.
These two questions.
I mean, it's not generally cooperatives all across the board. It's cooperatives, again, with particular features to link into the rate regulation. Paragraph 23, you're right to highlight, because that was an issue with the previous definition where it talked about by contract, so regulated, the authorised by contract. And that's what raised the question there with these monopolistic companies where there isn't an external or formal regulator, they just decide internally. The cooperatives, in some cases, are slightly
different. So you want to say no, exclude?
I think that was the decision of the board in the 2013 ED, which is why we put the comment in the basis for conclusion, but clearly that wasn't strong enough. 2013 ED, we put...
the interim.
Yeah, the interim ED. So paragraph 23 is talking about that interim ED. So that was a decision made quite recently. But obviously the comments in the basis for conclusion aren't strong enough, I would assume, from the fact that people have raised the comments. The cooperatives, again, was raised as a specific issue, both the 2009 ED and some of the requests for information and the 2013 ED. Cooperatives generally, and this is a very sweeping generalisation, are self-regulating bodies. And in that sense, I guess, wouldn't be captured by the quote in paragraph 23 that was in the interim exposure draft, because they are self-regulated. However, again, in terms of looking at a combination of different features, some of the cooperatives that deal with essential services, like the electricity cooperatives, some farming cooperatives, we've been made aware of, the regulation is kind of intertwined with an external type of regulation. So the cooperative would struggle to operate in isolation without the support of some governmental or other body. And they work in unison then to try and establish the prices that's going to protect both the customers and the entity to make sure that the goods are being supplied because of their essential nature. So it wouldn't be all cooperatives that we're suggesting are captured. It's those that their self-regulation is supported or overlaid with some external type of regulation.
Can I ask, what do you have in your mind, other regulatory body or external body? I mean, do you mean, what kind of power do they have? And my preference is it should be supported by some legal document or legislation.
Yeah.
That should be clearly, you should make clear that in your standard or in your drafting. Otherwise, you know, any self-regulation would be creeped in. The other thing is about deregulation or privatization. So in some stage, government make regulation, but in some stage, government deregulate those industries. So so how can they judge whether it has been deregulated? So first, regulation was very strict, but they are going to loosen their regulation. So then it come down to the self-regulatory body, but the government make some check. But then for some years later, government would lift that checking. So are you going to provide some guidance to judge whether they are no longer regulated or not? And my question is, what is the accounting procedure? Do you require when the industry is deregulated? So they may have a huge asset which they could collect, but they are no longer protected by the government. Okay. Then
shall we worry about that once we have decided?
Recognizing
them to begin.
We'll keep it on our radar, but we need to decide whether they're assets and liabilities before we start determining how we're accounting.
Okay.
Yeah.
This issue was brought up by the similar issue was brought up by the participants about the U.S. deregulating, and they had to deregulate it. So it was a very interesting situation they brought up. So.
Yeah. There was. I mean, I think generally, if the government decides to deregulate, it will be clear from the governmental pronouncements that they're deregulating, which, if we end up with some guidance that has an accounting mechanism for this, then yes, at that stage, presumably, we'd have to think about mechanisms for getting out of that accounting in deregulating. And there is some experience of that in the US at the moment as well.
If those so-called, which we still have to decide, regulatory assets, if they can be wiped out overnight by deregulation, then we have to wonder whether this is something that we want to recognize. Obviously, in most cases, that will not happen that way.
No. But often there's a kind of phased mechanism.
Exactly. That inelasticity of demand criterion that you've built in here, that will go through a transition, presumably. And so then when it becomes elastic because, let's say, wind farms start to proliferate or solar farms, presumably the government's going to say, well, we don't need to, you know, they may have rate regulation of a gas company because they don't want everybody to be operating gas companies for obvious reasons, but it may not meet that criterion, which I think that's a good point that Hans is making. I think that's a really critical element. And that consumer migration may in fact occur well before the bureaucracy and the government gets around to dismantling, saying you guys are out of business.
But actually, it is a very interesting question. It would be worthwhile studying some cases. For example, what's happening in Spain right now with solar energy, which where I think the investors were guaranteed a very high return, which could lead to regulatory assets, I suppose. But because of the obvious budgetary problems in Spain, I think they are being revised. Which goes to show how extremely uncertain these
one more question.
Situations can be.
No, we should put in a criteria called remote assessment.
whether it's genuine or not.
Genuine.
You could argue they're financial assets, not regulatory assets.
Can we get a flowchart,
Jane?
Yeah. just one more question. Just comparability. So we make a standard, and then in the same jurisdiction, the same industry category, and the same regulation, but one company says, we are regulated. The other, we are regulated industry. The other company could say that we are not regulated industry based on the assets and the liability. Yeah. So those who have a huge asset could assert we are regulated industry, so we recognize assets. The other company have a large liability, and then they would assert we are not regulated because. And then there would be a judgment call. So if we leave it judgment of each entity and the judgment of the auditors in the same jurisdiction, in the same industry, and they are peers and competitors, do you think it is possible that they have different financial statements?
They can assert, but they cannot conclude opposite way. They can assert. Anybody can assert.
Yeah.
But can they conclude? I think that's where if we come up with the standard, if we ever get to that, I think our scope will be so clear that it's in the same industry, in the same jurisdiction, A will say they are, B they won't. And the liabilities can flip to assets tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, the big liability, they cannot reassert. I don't think we will leave it that principle space that it will. We are trying to find out what are the common features that will first filter is to get to common features, then put the arms around and see which of those common features are determinative for us to do one way or the other. I it's theoretically possible, but I don't think we can get to that.
I don't know how they took care of this in the American standard.
They have all of them regulated.
Yeah, the advantage is that it's a much narrower range of regulatory types. Anyway, any more comments on paper 9B2 before moving
any
on?
Any more comments for the weekend talk?
Okay. Paper 9B3 then is looking at the mechanism and the feature of how does the rate regulator actually set the rates and ensure that the interests of the consumer and the interests of the entity are both balanced. And this was an area that, again, PK will say at the consultative group meeting, we had quite a long chat about these types of mechanisms. And the messages that came through really was that you need to have good transparency of the mechanism. So it should be something that's built into the legislation or the regulation, something that's not going to just change at the whim of the government, or, you know, it's got to be something that is reasonably objective. And there does need to be some sort of way that the cash flows associated with this can get to the entity. There were a couple of very specific cases mentioned where on occasion a rate regulator has said that retrospective billing can take place. So if there was an under-recovery of the amount of revenue permitted, then the company could send out bills to the specific customers that are the historical customers and recoup money that way by basically saying, you know, we didn't bill you enough in the last year, so we're going to bill you some more. Or alternatively, if they billed more revenue than they were entitled under the regulation, occasionally regulators have said you need to issue credit notes to those customers and make sure that they get the refund that way. Again, fairly rare situation, but we've been told about in Italy where there's a clearinghouse, which is a governmental body, where if the utility company earns an amount of revenue above that permitted, it has to send a check to the clearinghouse. Or if it doesn't earn the revenues that have been built into the mechanism, then the clearinghouse sends a check to the company. So there's cash flows. And people, certainly in the European meeting, were very happy with this mechanism because they thought that made the accounting relatively easy, in that there was a financial asset or liability at the end of the day. But sadly, those are the rare circumstances. The most common mechanism is an adjustment to the future rate. And what people were saying as being the distinguishing feature about this, which, you know, in a general business environment, if you incur more costs than you expected, you put your prices up and you can recoup those costs going forward. The difference here is that you've got a regulator that is determining the timing of your price adjustment and also how long it's going to take you to get that recovery back or refund the over-recovery. So the regulator is directly involved in not just the amount, but the timing and the certainty of those cash flows as well. And the mechanisms that they were looking at, that's very common in lots of different types of rate regulatory regimes, is one where the rate is calculated using two main components. One is based on the budgeted or forecast costs and volumes for the forthcoming period. That period could be 1 year, could be 3, 5 years, whatever. So it's called the regulatory period. Mm-hmm. And so there's a budget made and estimates made. What are the volumes? What are the costs? What prices can the customers cope with? But the price is set in that component to try and give the entity the what is determined to be the fair or reasonable rate of return on those activities for that regulatory period. Obviously, those are all based on estimates, so things can change, volumes can change a little bit, though not usually dramatically. Prices can change for the inputs. So there's usually a second component to a price then, which relates to the sales that have been made in the past at the previous fixed price, where the estimate hasn't been borne out by experience. In some regulatory regimes, this is actually distinguished on the bill, where if you look at your gas bill or electricity bill, there'll be the price per unit based on the current regulatory period, and then there'll be an adjustment, either increase or decrease, which is the adjustment related to the experience variance from the previous period. And again, people were seeing this mechanism, the adjustment, that second component, as a distinguishing feature of the rate regulatory mechanism. In a general commercial environment, people will combine the two elements. They'll say, well, for example, we've incurred more costs now at the price we've been charging. When we put our price up, we'll try and recoup the past costs. We'll anticipate those costs will continue in the future. We'll just have the higher rate. This is a more transparent and detailed mechanism to distinguish those features. And the second component, the adjustment, isn't always a permanent adjustment. It could just be for a fixed period of time to reverse out the balance that it relates to. So that was a feature that, again, we thought was an important distinguishing feature to incorporate within the discussion that we're going to have in the discussion paper. And the reason that we've been told lots of regulators use this mechanism is because of the other features, the monopolistic situation, the essential goods, the relative inelasticity of demand, which means the regulator can balance the needs of the customers and the entity itself by determining the timing of these adjustments. I did have a phone call a little while ago with a utility company in Germany that helped to explain to me more clearly the mechanism, because I was looking at some information that suggested that small variances, if this adjustment was quite small, it would be spread over the whole of the regulatory period that I can't remember exactly now, I think it was something like 3 years or 5 years. If that adjustment relating to the past was a large adjustment, it went through in a much shorter period, which I thought, and Patricia's face is looking, that's confusing, because I was thinking, well, that's creating a bit of variability in the price, but it was explained to me that the regulator there is saying, well, if it's a credit balance, it means the company has taken more money off the customers than it needed to take, and so it's very unfair to the customers then to not refund that in a short period of time. However, if it's the other way round and the company hasn't managed to collect enough in from the customers, it puts the company at risk which puts the supply of electricity at risk, that's no good for the customers either. So it puts the adjustment through more quickly to make sure the cash comes through into the company, that it's in a better position financially to fulfil its obligations to supply the essential goods. So it's this adjustment that people see as being a very important part of the mechanism to make it different than a general commercial environment.
And it's both upwards and downwards.
Upwards and downwards.
Jane, I didn't quite understand your question on the last page. There's a couple of words here that followed me. You've got an automatic adjustment, does it? I'm not sure what automatic means or whether it's necessary. It's just an adjustment, isn't it?
What I was trying to get across there was that the adjustment is built into the mechanism. So it's not something that if the company sees that it's got a problem, it will have to constantly go back and have a negotiation with the rate regulator.
But there is a negotiation most of the time, sort of an annual negotiation.
Yes, yeah, sometimes there is.
So
but
if it's not automatic, it doesn't really matter.
I think what I was trying to get at is if the mechanism anticipates this, there may still be some negotiation of the detail. But the reason for the negotiation is transparency built in.
Pre-agreed. And then based on past performance, will that always be the case? I mean, in some cases, you may go and negotiate on budgets. You're covering the costs, for instance, and you haven't got any others. And you go, and the rate will be determined on what you think your budget costs are going to be for the next year. May not be related to past performance at all.
The way they explained it, the working.
They do
the preliminary rate on the budget, and then they true up based on actual.
It's those two separate components. So the one component is based on future and the budget that we expected, and then the separate adjustment is the experience adjustment.
I just thought you could take those words out; wouldn't change. You know, the important things are that there's an adjustment. And there's a high level of certainty on the cash flow, so those are the two most important things. I don't see a little bit of
security. It just means both ways, because I'll tell you why I'm saying this again and again. Health insurance in the United States, there is an insurance supervisor. And more often than not, I don't know whether health insurance is going to be part of the trade regulator. I'm not presupposing it. But all the time I see is only when the health insurance company increases the rates, insurance regulator will bring it down. I've never seen in my 22 years in America where insurance guy comes and says, please charge me more. Yeah. So it's always adjustment is one way. So that's why I'm using the word adjustments is both ways in this situation.
Yeah. I mean, there are one or two circumstances. It comes back to something Martin said earlier about in some jurisdictions and some types of industries, they're trying to encourage competition, and I have seen a couple of examples where the regulator has insisted that the company increases the price because it allows more competition to come in. It's trying to stop a company blocking competition by making the prices too low.
Yeah.
So it can go both ways.
Yeah, I agree with the two comments from Ian.
Yeah.
Automatic adjustment will give people wrong image. You can do what you want.
Actually, you started in descent right now.
I help you. I try to help you. And secondly, based on past performance, you know, in reality, you know, maybe based on the cost that you suffer, not performance.
Well, it's cost, suffer, past of performance, as you see.
Performance is more than just cost. So there are some elements you picked up on the obligations that they might have targets
for. Okay, but that's the cost is part of it. I'm not saying it's all of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sort of based on past performance might be important is establishing the right. So something has to happen for you to have a right to be able to increase or an obligation even to decrease price. So I think we do need to be careful about that
one. What, Michael, if there's no adjustments year to year, but you go and have a negotiation and you just try the agreement is you cover costs plus make a 5% profit. You go and negotiate that. That's not based on past performance.
But the right arises once you perform, you've delivered under the agreed framework, and because you delivered at X, you might have a right to claim more or less in a future. It's the
stretching it.
Asset or liability will arise only based on a past performance, right? So if you are saying that next year I will charge $10 extra, but not because of anything that happened in the past, I don't know whether those meet the definition of an asset or a liability in my mind. So somehow linkage to past will reduce the scope rather than increase the scope.
I'll take that point. I'm not sure if it is helpful that we're going to vote on all these issues. I suggest that you use the wisdom that you received at this table this afternoon.
That's fine. We can work around that. As long as nobody was going to strike out any of these features completely, then we can work around those as our basis.
Who wants to say whatever that doesn't help.
Yeah. But then, our plan is now then to use these to start our analysis in the conceptual framework and bring that to you the next. But I thank you very much.
Comes
indeed.
From a regulated entity in the background.
We can simplify.
Okay.